Hello, I'm Jeff Watts and welcome to Optometric Quarterly 84. The interviews in this edition look at normal tension glaucoma and the effects of smoking on eye health. In the quarterly review, Jeff Roberson has, among other topics, also chosen to discuss glaucoma and the effects of smoking on the eye. As ever, you can access and download current and past editions of Optometric Quarterly directly from your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch using our app, which can be found and downloaded for free by searching Docket in the iTunes Store. The Docket website at www.docket.info is now mobile optimized for smartphones and tablets, giving you even more ways to access OQ wherever you are. Why not let us know your thoughts and ideas for the program by completing our survey and suggesting future topics via the app or the website? After you've listened to OQ84, you can earn a CET point by answering the multiple-choice questions found on the Docket website or in the CET area of the Docket app. Just a reminder that with the current CET cycle closing at the end of December, if you want your CET points for this edition of OQ to count towards this CET cycle, your MCQs must be submitted via the Docket website by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, December the 19th. Any responses submitted after this will not be uploaded until after the start of the next cycle in January 2013. Our first item is a two-part interview about normal tension glaucoma. Worldwide, glaucoma is the second leading cause of blindness after cataracts, affecting 1 in 200 people under the age of 50 and 1 in 10 people over 80. Most kinds of glaucoma involve damage to the optic nerve associated with elevated intraocular pressure, but this is not the case with normal tension glaucoma. Less is known about this form of the disease, also known as normal pressure glaucoma or low tension glaucoma, despite it representing a significant proportion of glaucoma cases. In this interview, Polly Dully talks to Gus Gazzard, a consultant specializing in glaucoma and cataracts at Moorfields, about the causes, development, diagnosis, and treatment of the condition. The first part of the interview concentrates on how the disease differs from other forms of glaucoma.
Could you remind us how normal tension glaucoma differs from other forms of glaucoma in terms of its causes and its development?
I think it's important to consider whether or not normal tension glaucoma, or NTG, or as some people refer to it, low pressure primary open angle glaucoma, is actually a different disease or just part of a spectrum. And I think in my view, I would consider it to be part of a spectrum of disease, with at one end glaucomatous optic neuropathy with low pressures, and at the other end glaucomatous optic neuropathy with high pressures. Within that range, there's a wide range of risk factors and precipitating causes. High pressure disease is purely pressure dependent. Low pressure disease clearly has something else going on, something else involved. So it's very hard to make a clear cutoff or a clear distinction between the two ends of that spectrum. And in the middle, there's a grey area where there's probably a combination of causes and risk factors equally applying. For the low pressure disease, for the NTG, normal tension glaucomas, where it's much more a pressure independent disease, there's clearly larger roles for other risk factors and other causes of glaucomatous optic neuropathy. And those are probably a wide range of vascular and other factors that cause damage to the optic nerve at lower intraocular pressures. The vascular risk factors are many and varied that have been measured and looked at. Some of the studies have looked at peripheral vascular behaviour and the way in which peripheral blood vessels behave in response to cold and other stimuli. There's some interesting papers that took people with low pressure glaucoma and stuck their hands in cold buckets of ice water and looked at how their blood vessels behaved, and they behaved very differently from people who had normal high pressure primary open angle glaucoma. So clearly they were behaving in a different way throughout the blood vessels of their whole body. Some of the other differences where people have measured blood flow or tried to measure blood flow in the nerve or the retina are perhaps less clearly about what causes glaucoma, and they may just be differences that occur at the same time as glaucoma or as a result of glaucoma. But there is some evidence that abnormalities of blood flow within the optic nerve head itself is much more important in the low pressure POAG or the NTGs. There are signs of other epiphenomena, other characteristics that occur in normal tension glaucoma that have a bearing on the cause of the disease. We know that disc hemorrhages are much more common in NTG. Some people have used that to interpret the greater influence of vascular risk factors in the nerve damage compared to POAG or primary open angle glaucoma. We're unclear whether that's a cause or a consequence of the difference in pressure, but certainly there's a very clear difference between the two disease groups. We have to remember when we're calling somebody normal pressure or high pressure that that's also a statistical construct. Normal is defined as two standard deviations from the mean, but we have a skewed distribution, and the derivation of the magical number 21 was from Schiot's tonometry in a mixed bag of patients many, many years ago. So to have an arbitrary cutoff between the two groups is perhaps rather artificial. Rather, I like to think of this continuous spectrum of influence of different characteristics, risk factors, which have a greater or lesser impact on the glaucoma.
And so how prevalent do you think NTG actually is?
It's interesting. We used to think it was very rare, and certainly around the time I was starting ophthalmology, people talked about it as being a very different disease and very rare and a particular peculiar entity in itself. Around the same time, a lot of studies were being published that were showing that actually it isn't rare, it's just rare in clinics. And what that means is that we weren't as good at finding it as we were at finding high-pressure glaucoma. And clearly there's a very good reason for that. We find high-pressure glaucoma by checking pressures, but if we check pressures for normal tension glaucoma, the pressure's normal and our suspicions are not aroused and we don't necessarily look as carefully as we might do at other characteristics of the eye. So high-pressure disease is regularly found, whereas low-pressure disease is less commonly found. So as a result, we have less low-pressure disease in our clinics, and we have a very biased view of how common it is, and also a biased view of its characteristics. The most recent data that I've seen is, I think as yet unpublished, but from the EPIC Norfolk study, where of all the undiagnosed disease, and about half of the glaucomas that they found in this epidemiological survey were undiagnosed, as is common throughout the West. Of those undiagnosed cases, 90% were NTG. So there were almost no undiagnosed high pressure disease because everyone was having their pressures tested. But there were a lot of undiagnosed NTG, which obviously tells us that we need to look more carefully at the discs and fields of potential suspect patients. In terms of the absolute prevalence rate, how common is it? Some numbers from older studies, the Baltimore Eye Survey found that 24% of those people with glaucoma had normal pressures. As more modern studies have looked more carefully, that figure has tended to rise, and the Beaver Dam found about a third, and the Blue Mandison's Eye Survey in Australia found about a half of those people with glaucoma had normal pressures. So there's a large contribution to the burden of glaucoma in European-derived populations is from the low-pressure disease. And clearly, that's not quite represented even now in our clinics, but we are beginning to see more of it as optometrists in practice are getting much better than when I was first in practice myself, getting much better at detecting abnormal nerves and abnormal fields.
Clearly, measuring the pressures isn't going to be terribly helpful. So could you just elaborate a little bit on what optometrists should be looking for in particular to help detect NTG?
The defining characteristic of NTG is that there is an individual with a glaucomous optic neuropathy. So the two characteristics of that, the abnormal visual field and the abnormal optic disc, the abnormal optic nerve head, are clearly the two aspects of any particular individual's ophthalmic examination, which are going to require careful and detailed assessment and examination. The visual field out in practice will normally be a supra-threshold screening field, and that will pick up all but the most mild of abnormalities of field. In terms of examining the disc, it's the standard characteristics of any glaucomatous optic nerve with increased cupping, changes in patterns of cupping, etc., and abnormalities of the nerve fibre layer. So, because you don't have abnormal pressure to guide you, one has to fall back on these other two characteristics, and one is therefore more reliant on those two characteristics. And that becomes a problem because there is a wide range of normal in the optic nerve appearance. If we were to look at every abnormal or potentially abnormal disc, then we would find that there were an awful lot of funny-looking discs being referred up with normal pressures and normal fields. I think we have to be careful where we set our criteria for onward referral for those individuals, because otherwise there's a large number of borderline and false positives being sent into the hospital eye service, which it can't deal with. Certainly, a combination of suspicious nerve and field defect would be a strong indicator for onward referral.
And are there any particular groups of patients in which the condition is more likely to occur?
There's certainly some evidence coming out from the Far East or East Asia that some groups there have a higher prevalence of low pressure glaucoma. NTG was found in one survey to be responsible for 90% of glaucoma in Japan. And that's a very well-conducted survey. There are two aspects of that. One is their normal pressures are slightly lower. So actually using a cutoff as they did of 21 was perhaps incorrect. That's not the median pressure, or that's not rather two standard deviations from their median pressure. And they should have dropped their cutoff probably to 19 or 20. But that also applies for several other races in the Far East that they have, on average, a lower pressure. But even allowing for that, the Japanese certainly, and possibly the Chinese, seem to have a slightly higher prevalence of NTG. In Japan, that's the most extreme case, and a large proportion of the glaucoma disease in clinics there is of a low pressure variety, for reasons that we really don't understand. In terms of other groups within the European populations, there are no particular lifestyle or other health characteristics which were particularly associated with it, although there are some risk factors such as having sleep apnea seems to damage the optic nerve in some susceptible individuals, so that could be considered a risk factor for this. What is known to be important is refractive error. Now, there are debates around the influence of extremes of myopia on the prevalence rates of glaucoma, between debates within ophthalmologists and epidemiologists particularly. But my personal view of the literature, based on data from China and data from the Blue Mountains Eye Survey particularly, is that there does seem to be a dose-response relationship between the degree of myopia and the risk of having glaucoma, and in particular, the risk of having a low-pressure glaucoma. So to restate that in another way, the more short-sighted you are, the more likely you are to have glaucoma, but the more short-sighted you are, the more you are particularly likely to have a low-pressure version of the disease, or NTG.
What are the more subtle differences in the way that NTG presents itself that a practice-based optometrist should be looking out for?
That's a very interesting question, because that touches on aspects of why we detect NTG and how we detect NTG at all. And I think we, again, touched on earlier the fact that the groups of patients that we see in a hospital clinic are quite different from the patients that exist out in the community, because we only see those who are detected. So traditionally, NTG has been thought to have fundamentally different characteristics, and there are a lot of papers from Japan and Taiwan particularly that have suggested that NTG has got different patterns of nerve damage and therefore different patterns of visual field loss. They proposed, and others have done so elsewhere, that NTG has got visual field loss that is more likely to be close to fixation, that is more likely to have a deeper scotoma, particularly close to fixation, and that the optic nerves are likely to be more severely affected at any stage of the disease, and that they are more likely to have very, very deep cut-out areas of neuroretinal rim notching, although that's only a few papers that suggest that. However, all of those characteristics described in all of those papers derive from hospital clinic-based populations. And so therefore what they're really saying is that the cases that are detected have these characteristics. Because they have normal pressure, we are all clearly more likely to detect disease that have more extreme versions of visual field loss or disc damage. The disc damage they describe for these patients is more severe. So of course, they're more likely to be detected. The mild versions of the disease with normal pressures are not picked up. The same applies for the visual fields. If you have a visual field that's defect that is close to fixation, patients are more likely to be symptomatic, and they are more likely to seek out help and more likely to seek out an optometrist who then, with their screening and their case finding, picks up the problem. So in a sense, there aren't any clear differences that distinguish one from the other than the absence of a raised pressure. They are part of a spectrum of a very similar pattern of disease and pattern of nerve damage. The apparent differences arise from what we are able to detect. So if you are sitting out in practice trying to establish whether an individual has NTG, needs to be looked at, needs to be referred, the same criteria that we use for POAG apply, and the same criteria as we mentioned earlier on in this interview. Disc damage, visual field loss, particularly where those two occur together, in a pattern which is consistent. So superior visual field loss with inferior nerve damage. The difficulty arises when you have only one or other of those characteristics. And in those situations, I think repeatability of visual field loss is important. So a repeat visual field, because if that is all you have to go on, it's very likely to be an artifact or a mistake of measurement. In terms of disc damage, if you only use a disc criterion and all other things are normal, then one would probably wish to be very slightly more stringent in the application of criteria for cup disc ratio abnormalities or cup disc ratio asymmetries, because otherwise one will be sending up a large number of false positives of people who have simply have abnormal discs. But certainly in my practice of patients that I come across, I would continue to monitor with visual fields, albeit intermittently, people who have cup disc ratio greater than 0.2 of CDR between the two eyes, as long as the two discs are equivalent in size. And if somebody had visual field abnormalities alone, then I might follow them intermittently with disc assessments once a year, but with an automated disc assessment using an OCT OptiView scanner or HRT or other form of objective image analysis.
Bearing in mind optometrists in practice can't include the third method of finding glaucoma, that is intraocular pressure measurement, is it appropriate that they should be checking visual fields using a threshold test rather than a supra-threshold test? Do you think that would improve their likelihood of picking up earlier NTG?
Thresholding field tests are certainly much more sensitive and more accurate. But in that, there's the problem that you're also going to have more false positives. So I think for a routine screening procedure in which you do not have a diagnosis already made, that having a supra-threshold test is probably the most appropriate, because otherwise you're going to end up diverting a lot of your attention and resources to individuals that have very, very borderline field abnormalities. Now, if somebody comes to me for diagnosis, yes, they will get a thresholding field, but that does lead to the need to repeat that in a certain number of individuals. Somebody I saw yesterday is absolutely plumb normal in every respect, except that they've got a highly suspicious looking field. But it is the first field that they've ever done in their life, and clearly they need to have that done again to confirm it. And a large proportion of people in his situation will simply have a normal field on their second or third testing. If we're doing a randomised controlled trial in glaucoma, we throw away the first visual field, or sometimes the first two visual fields, because the learning effect's so strong. That's less of a problem if you're doing supra-threshold screening fields, because they're more robust. It's a more robust test. So I think a move away from supra-threshold screening fields to thresholding fields would generate a lot of additional false positives and a lot of additional work. And we'd have to think very carefully before anyone were to advise taking that step out in the community, because I've got, in a sense, an easier diagnostic conundrum. I have to decide whether one individual in front of me who's very likely to have disease has got disease or not. Community-based optometrist who is seeing thousands of patients a year, the vast majority of whom are normal, has got a very difficult needle in a haystack distinction to make between that one person who may be a false positive or may have early disease out of a whole load of individuals who are entirely normal. So changing the thresholds for investigation or testing a tiny bit for them makes a huge difference to workload and an impact on their practice.